Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Well, because you're evidently a public radio listener, you've probably heard about the retraction by the show This American Life of Mike Daisy's story, The Agony and the Ecstasy of Steve Jobs. In January, This American Life excerpted and aired a portion of Daisy's one-man show that has been running at the Public Theater. It became This American Life's most listened to episode ever. And in that show, Daisy presents, as truth, the story of going to Foxconn in Shenzhen and other factories where they manufacture Apple products in China, and meeting underage workers there, visiting factory dorms, meeting hexane-poisoned workers, and other things that turned out to be not exactly true. Rob Schmitz, the China correspondent for another public radio show, Marketplace, from American Public Media, uncovered Mike Daisy's lies. He joins us now. He was on with Ira Glass in this past weekend's hour-long show dedicated to clearing up these lies. And On the Media, host and managing editor Brooke Gladstone also joins us. Hi, Rob. Hi, Brooke.
Hi.
Rob, when you heard this story by Mike Daisy originally, you and I gather many other reporters in China thought it was fishy right away. Why?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of my friends and I, we all, you know, reporters, we all thought that it was a little strange just because there were a lot of details that just, if you've lived here in China, reported here in China, don't ring true. I mean, one of the details that I thought seemed a little strange was that he mentioned guards with guns outside the gates of Foxconn. And in China, I've reported in several factories, and you never see factory guards with guns. And in fact, security guards in China aren't allowed to carry guns. It's usually just the military and police that you'll see with guns. So that was one of, several details that just didn't seem right.
So you tracked down Kathy, Mike Daisy's translator. Ira Glass says that Daisy lied to him and to the This American Life team about her real name and said that she was unreachable, so This American Life didn't contact her. But you did locate her, and I want to play about a minute from This American Life from this weekend where they're clearing these things up. You replay a section of Mike Daisy's original monologue, a dramatic part in his narrative about showing his iPad to a guy he says got his hand mangled on the factory line making iPads. You hear Mike Daisy in this clip, folks, and then the translator, Kathy, her reaction to that story.
When he says this, I reach into my satchel and I take out my iPad. And when he sees it, his eyes widen because one of the ultimate ironies of globalism, at this point, there are no iPads in China. He's never actually seen one on this thing that took his hand. I turn it on, unlock the screen, and pass it to him. He takes it. The icons flare into view, and he strokes the screen with his ruined hand. And the icons slide back and forth. And he says something to Kathy. And Kathy says, he says, it's a kind of magic.
No, this is not true. It's, you know, it's just like a movie scenery.
Like movie scenery. So, Rob, she gets that Daisy's version tells a more dramatic story than the truth. Did she also seem offended by the lies, offended that we in the West would believe the lies so readily or anything?
No, you know, she didn't really seem that offended at all until I made it clear to her that the monologue that Daisy has done and, you know, that he used this material for has actually helped shape the public perception about working conditions in China. When I made that point to her, and I think that there was a point in the This American Life episode where I talked to her about this, she finally starts to realize that this might not be a great idea and that this is actually something that really she doesn't feel great about at all. And she as a translator in China wants to make China understandable to foreigners. And this, in her opinion, was something that was actually not doing that. And so she didn't feel good about that.
So, Brooke Gladstone, why do you think that Western public radio listening audiences and I guess the producers of This American Life were duped? Is this the story about the man with the hand who says the iPad is magic, a story we want to believe? Does it confirm a narrative we already have in our minds, in our heads about China? Can we chalk it up to things like that?
I think we should get clear on this, and it was clear in many of the discussions, is that the principal thrust of this story is based on reporting from reliable sources all across the country and across the world.
Ira's story or Mike Daisy's theatrical
Daisy's
performance?
The essence of Mike Daisy's stories, minus the Hollywood scenery, as Kathy put it, is fundamentally true. Those working conditions exist. It's also true that working conditions at Western factories tend to be better than working conditions at Chinese-owned factories. But we still have a responsibility not to make those people's lives who are making our luxury products miserable and induce them to commit suicide, as happened at Foxconn. So I think the biggest problem here is that the superficial lies that were told to create drama and you know, the use of metaphor to make the impact greater will distract us from the fact that the fundamentals of the story are essentially correct.
So you see them as merely superficial lies?
No, I don't think they're merely, because the consequences of them are enormously great. For instance, people who hear the superficial top of this story will think, oh, well, then I guess there aren't working condition problems in China. Well, that's a terrible misapprehension, and it would be a shame if the fact that this story were called a lie would give the lie to the much larger story. Another thing is, it'll probably hurt a little bit the Western press and the international workers' rights groups now currently on the ground in China.
So in the third act of This American Life yesterday, Ira interviews the New York Times reporter Charles Duhigg, who, along with his colleague David Barboza, wrote a series of New York Times articles about Apple in China. Duhigg lays out what he calls two buckets related to working conditions. The first is harsh working conditions, super long hours, forced to sit on chairs with no backs, tight living quarters. And you'll hear what he says about the second bucket.
I think you can trust my word in the context of the theater and how people see it.
I find this to be like a really hedgy answer. I think it's okay for somebody in your position to say that it isn't all.
All right. Sorry, that was the wrong clip. We'll get the Duhigg clip in just a minute. But Rob Schmitz, while we're getting it ready, on this same point, so that people don't walk away from Mike Daisy's false story thinking everything is A-OK at Apple factories in China, please tell us what the working conditions are really like in these factories, as you've documented in your reporting.
Well, I think Brooke is correct. I mean, these things do happen in China. All the things that Mike Daisy mentioned in his monologue are things that have actually happened. There have been poison workers, you know, and I've interviewed these workers. And Apple's own audits have caught underage workers at factories making Apple products. You know, but I think that there's another fact that's also missing from this conversation. You know, all of these things, poison workers, underage workers, maimed workers, from what we know, you know, these are rare occurrences in Apple's supply chain and the supply chain of many foreign electronics manufacturers. And these you know, life at factories that make Apple products, for example, is not all hunky-dory. But I think what's missing here seems to be that the truth is a lot more complicated than how Daisy is portraying the situation.
So now we have that Charles Duhigg clip, Duhigg from The Times, who did a lot of reporting on working conditions at Apple-related factories in China. And he talks about these two buckets of working conditions. One is super long hours, forced to sit on chairs with no backs, tight living quarters, things like that.
That's the first bucket of issues. And those are all kind of, we wouldn't like to work there. It sounds really unpleasant. I do not think that you would find any factory in America where you would find those same conditions, and you would not find any Americans who would tolerate those conditions. That being said, I think that China is a little bit different, and that the expectations, particularly as a developing nation, of workers are a little bit different. I don't think holding them to American standards is precisely the right way to look at this situation.
Mm-hmm.
The second bucket, which is much smaller, is actually safety and life-threatening issues. And what we know about those conditions are isolated incidents that either injured or claimed lives.
So Mike Daisy's story and play suggests that the second bucket, the life-threatening conditions, are more common than they are. But, Brooke, it's not as if fabricating the story is the only way to make this story evocative. The New York Times pieces definitely landed with the audience. We spent a lot of time on them here because of the New York Times, much more than Mike Daisy. And Ira Glass is an expert at delivering true stories with impact.
I was going to say that. If anybody knows how to be rigorous when it comes to telling a story and yet tell it for maximum impact, maximum identification of the audience, then it would be Ira Glass. But Ira Glass is a rare practitioner. What Daisy does on stage, I think, absent the misleading details and the factual inaccuracies, is close to what Ira does. Ira tells a story. He tells, or his program tells a story, but he tells stories with real facts. That's different from the New York Times pieces, which are news that we care about, but does, you know, and creates a lot of interest in the public, but not that emotional connection. But Ira does it. There are very few practitioners that do. There's this new book out called The Lifespan of a Fact, an argument between a fact checker and an essayist. An essayist built a story about a boy committing suicide, largely based on fact, but a few details changed to maximize the impact. And he saw that as a kind of larger emotional truth. Most of us, as Ira said in his retraction yesterday, you know, believe that facts are facts.
Essays are supposed to be true, though, unlike short stories. So how much license do you feel comfortable granting people?
None, obviously. I don't want to be in this position. The fact is that there is a truth in labeling problem. But the very essayists frequently who feel that changing the details will give greater impact knows that calling something based on fact rather than fact will diminish that impact.
And so Daisy asserts in his excruciating interview with Ira for This Weekend that his only regret is allowing This American Life to present this as journalism.
I think you can trust my word in the context of the theater and how people see it.
I find this to be like a really hedgy answer. I think it's okay for somebody in your position to say that it isn't all literally true. Do you know what I mean? I feel like actually it seems like it's honest labeling. And I feel like that's what's actually called for at this point is just honest labeling. Like you make a nice show, people are moved by it, I was moved by it. And if it were labeled honestly, I think everybody would react differently to it.
I don't think that label covers the totality of what it is.
The label fiction.
Yeah. We have different worldviews on some of these things. I agree that
I know, but I feel like, but I feel like I have the normal worldview. Like the normal worldview is somebody stands on a stage and says, this happened to me. I think it happened to them, unless it's clearly labeled of here's a work of fiction.
So that from This Weekend's This American Life. We're going to run out of time soon. But Brooke, you know, Daisy's show, his stage version of this ended its run last night, coincidentally, at the Public Theater. And this story broke on Friday, so he had a few shows to do after the story was out there. And in the final performances, I understand, he changed the piece and added a prologue, but still maintains that he stands by his work. I'm curious, and I have no idea how audiences reacted in these last couple of nights.
It's a little slicing and dicing. He stands by his work of theater. He stands by his work of emotional truth. And Ira's expression, I feel like I have the normal worldview in an environment where everybody can claim they understand the facts, feels like a primal scream to me.
Rob Schmitz from Marketplace, who uncovered the untruths in Mike Daisy's story. You get our last 30 seconds. Where does reporting go from here? And has any of this landed in China?
No, this has largely not landed in China yet, and I don't know. I think it'll be interesting to see what does happen and what you know how the public sees this and how it's inserted into the narrative. about working conditions in China, my sense is that it's really not going to have a great impact on it. Because I think that the truth here in China is that it's very complicated. And I sometimes think that it's a lot easier to understand a simple narrative, a narrative that Mike Daisy was putting out.
Rob Schmitz from Marketplace, Brooke Gladstone from On the Media. The conversation continues. Thanks a lot.